Hello, my name is Alexis P. Morgan, and my favorite thing is magic.
Welcome to the Finding Favorites podcast, where we explore your favorite things without using an algorithm. Here's your host, Leah Jones.
Hello, and welcome to Finding Favorites. I'm your host, Leah Jones, and it is Sunday, October 31st. It's Halloween, and boy, does Chicago have perfect weather for Halloween. This weekend has been a super fun weekend. My twin sister came up and we're helping my nephew move into his very first Chicago apartment. And then we did a fire pit and told spooky stories and drank hot cider and ate Halloween candy. And now I'm just watching the sky get brighter and looking forward to another nice fall day. This week I got my Chemoport, which is a device that sits right under my skin to help with IVs and chemo infusion for the next year. 12 weeks of chemo, but they keep it in for a while for other treatments and other possibilities. So that is a weird, very weird sensation. But it's healing, and I'm getting more mobility back every day. This week on Finding Favorites, we have Alexis Morgan. Alexis is my neighborhood sorceress. She works in magic. It is also happens to be her birthday. Happy birthday, Alexis. I didn't necessarily plan that when we recorded this episode, but it's kind of fun. So I hope you are having a wonderful birthday and that this year is outstanding. We talk a lot about how she got called into doing magic and the differences between hoodoo and voodoo, initiation rites. And we also talk about Juno Jar, which is a service that she offers that starts, signups go up tomorrow for this wealth building service. Listen to her describe it. There'll be a link in the show notes to her website with all the information. And yeah, I hope that you have a wonderful Halloween. And I definitely want to see pictures of your cute, all the costumes. I want to see all the costumes. You can follow me on social media at Chicago Leah on Twitter and TikTok at Shy Leah on Instagram. Finding Favorites, you can find at Finding Faves Pod on Twitter and Instagram. Wear your mask, wash your hands, and keep enjoying your favorite things.
Hello, and welcome to Finding Favorites, the podcast where we get recommendations from people without using an algorithm. Tonight, I am here with Alexis P. Morgan. Alexis is my neighborhood sorceress. She is a creative. They do collage, works in radical luxury. One of the most fascinating people that I am connected with in the hell hole, blazing dumpster fire, that is Facebook. And we were introduced indirectly by one of the most dumpster fiery people on the internet that I've ever sat in a conference room with. Alexis, how are you doing this evening?
I'm fantastic. I still think about that like incident a lot. Am I allowed to name names?
You are allowed to name names, yes.
I just, like, as I was saying earlier, like, Gary is, like, meeting you was the only good thing that came out of ripping Gary Vaynerchuk a new ass.
Alexis had a online interaction, ripping of a new asshole of Gary Vaynerchuk, and then kind of put out a call saying, does anybody know, like, you kind of said to the people you are connected with, does anyone know anything about this guy? And a mutual of ours, Sydney, was like, tagged me in and I was like, what do you need to know? I've been in a conference room with them before. I have opinions. What would be helpful to know? And you all had like planned a dinner to meet in person, to talk in person. And then he either no-showed or canceled last minute or like, he had bought a really great dress for it.
I did. That dress was spectacular and wildly inappropriate for the dinner. I was about to show up with like cat pasties on with the mesh dress. Like it just would have been not cute at all. What actually ended up happening is he sent his little minion to cancel on me because the heat died down for a little bit. And I said to my assistant at the time, just wait, if it kicks back up, he'll be back. And lo and behold, it kicked back up again because Jason Falls shared my article on Twitter. So it started going, you know, all over the place. So of course the team had to hop back on that fire. So I sat on it and I watched Gary's socials for like a few days just to kind of see what he was posting. And I ended up responding to the email about rescheduling with, no, thank you. You have disrespected my time and treated me as if my time is not as valuable as yours. Kick rocks and be blessed. And he read the email like 12 times because I had like a tracker.
Yeah.
So that's what happened. And I was looking for information because we were going to talk face to face because I called his bluff because he pulled up on my Medium post and was just like, you know, if he could break bread and in person, he would see that I'm not a bad guy. I was just like, that's literally not the point of this, of this critique, but okay, sir. All right. I'll call you bluff. And then, oh, look, he disappeared.
Yeah.
But it's fine because that wasn't supposed to be my path anyways, which is why we're here tonight.
Right.
Because I do magic for a living, which was not the original plan.
Right. You have been trying, I don't know, was that like 4 or 5 years ago?
Yeah, maybe. That was 2018. Yeah.
Okay.
2018.
And you have... basically been trying not to do magic the whole time we've known each other.
Yeah.
And your guides and your ancestors keep, they just keep putting detours, perhaps, on your...
Yes.
You're like, I've got a plan. And they're like, okay. So how has... Right, because tonight you're in this beautiful white top and you were doing divinations before we came online. We were just running down what the planets have been up to because it was Mercury retrograde and Saturn retrograde and Jupiter and tonight's a full moon. And so we've just been getting all of it lately.
Yeah.
So maybe we're just getting right into it. So today you were doing divinations. In my understanding, you're like kind of always doing magic, but today was like active versus maybe passive magic?
Well, so it depends on how you define like active and passive. So active in the sense that I was dealing with clients. So like every day it's just about, I have a routine of like things that I do and like maintenance work that I have to do. I tell people all the time that being a professional witch is not at all glamorous because 90% of my workload is just like cleaning up offerings, just like praying quietly, like in my closet, which is not like what necessarily comes to mind when you say professional witch or bruja or priestess or whatever. And the Tom Fool to somebody. But just about every day I have key practices that I do both for myself, but also on behalf of my community, because I have a magical community that I run called Lucifer's Well, which is a really great name to turn away all the love and lightsy kind of folks who are going to be judgy and sketchy. And also for the handful of retainer clients that I do have, which are all, they're all super great. and unique cases unto themselves. I didn't want retainer clients, but of course, as we've established, my ancestors just kind of make me do things. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because I have been, my first experience like with magical stuff, like formal experience, was actually when I was a preteen, which is pretty common in like occult spaces. Like if you were to send around a survey, it's like all the first time magic stories are somewhere between the age of 12 and like 16, and usually involve either a crush, a bully, or like a weird shop that a child shouldn't have been in by themselves.
Right. Right, or a dusty book in the back of the library and a librarian who lets you have free reign.
Yeah, like it's usually some combination of like those things. And in my particular case, I was crawling around the adult section of the library and I got hit in the face with an unshelved, improperly like shelved copy of Dane McCoy's If You Want to Be a Witch, which mm-hmm. now I wouldn't recommend. For various reasons.
Right.
But 13-year-old me was just like, ooh, what is this?
Yeah.
Witch? Because, you know, we were coming off like the Harry Potter craze, like before J.K. Rowling went full body, turfy, awful. And it was a formative experience, but that quickly puttered out because my family was not very kind or supportive about it. And then I want to say, well, 7 years later, I was like 21. One of my first set of adoptive parents, that's a whole story, mm-hmm. Passed away. And I had this overwhelming urge to get a new tarot deck. Mm-hmm. And the ball went kind of rolling down the hill. And at the time, like, I didn't intend for this to be a vocation, let alone like a hobby, but then, you know, it just kind of kept going.
One tarot deck led to many tarot decks.
Yeah, one tarot deck led to reading cards and studying the cards like 14 hours a week, like a part-time job, led to developing a collection, led to buying my first book on actual magic, which was The Sorcerer's Secrets by Jason Miller, which is a pretty solid book that I do recommend.
Okay, great. I will link to that one.
Yes, although I have side eye for basically all of Mice's white men colleagues because, oh boy, just a lot of mess on that front in magical spaces. Mm-hmm. And then it just kind of took on a life of its own. Like I thought it was going to be an attorney.
Okay. That is only knowing you in your grown-up chapter. I would say an attorney is not what I would have pinned on you.
Really?
Yeah, it's shocking, I know.
What would you have pinned on me?
Well, honestly, any of the things that you've tried to do, you know, like, it wouldn't surprise me if you were someone who made all their money from writing or from voiceover or from collage and art. If like, none of that would have surprised me. And also, I would say, like, advocate for artists. Like, I think there's some things about law that also makes sense for you, but like the American lawyer system doesn't make sense for, you know.
Yeah. And like in hindsight now that I've known people who have gone through law school and I've dated several lawyers and, you know, had those conversations, I now look at that and go, child, what?
Yeah.
Like, I would have been absolutely fucking miserable if that plan had worked out.
Think it's often one of the only, there's not a lot of careers presented, you know, unless you, I don't know how people find careers that aren't doctor, lawyer, teacher, nurse.
Yeah.
Right. Like how did, like, that's what we see on TV. Those are like the I don't know.
Yeah. But speaking to like finding like careers like that, I think that's like a very purposeful sort of like architecture of how mm-hmm. our school system works.
Yeah.
But like, as I keep telling people, like, had anybody told me, you know, when I was like even like 16 or 18, you know, you're going to be a full-time witch who runs a digital community dedicated to political magic and talking about politics and magic. You know, and a writer and an artist and this and that. And the other thing, I just would have probably sat there in dumbfounded silence and been like, what drugs are you on? Can I have some?
Yeah.
because like, I say this to like my community all the time. I don't really understand how people pick up spiritual stuff as a hobby. Because in my, like, from the various cultures that make up my background, some of which I am more familiar with than others, because I am descended from Black folks, you know, who were enslaved. So we don't have a lot of those records.
Right.
You know, like, you don't get to choose to do this kind of work. Like, it's chosen for you. So my experience is kind of like going around and around in a circle. You know, developing this massive library and a footlocker full of tarot decks, and me going, no, this is just a thing that I do. This is a phase. I'll get through it. It'll be fine.
So Alexis just did what many of my guests do, which is look slightly off camera at a large collection. It's happened, no matter what people I interview people about, it's always like just off screen and they're looking at this large collection. So you were looking at tarot cards and library.
Well, so my library is actually out. I have all of my books that won't freak guests out like up front. And then I have the ones that are a little sketchy behind, I live in a studio, so I have it partitioned off, behind like both of my, partitions where like, you can't necessarily see the titles too much.
Yeah.
But you know, I was actually looking at my bone set. I was telling Leah earlier that, I had pulled my bone set out, which I'm showing her now, because I was talking to a client about bone reading. And bone reading as a form of divination that is, as the name implies, you throw bones onto the ground and then you interpret them. But you also throw, like, bone sets can have like little bits and bobs, like they can have like little pendants or a piece of jewelry or a shell or a stick, pebble, whatever. You know, and each of these different pieces. In hoodoo, which is one of the traditions that I practice out of, hoodoo is a form of Black USCN folk magic. So it's the folk magic of Black people in the United States, but it's also an ancestor veneration tradition. It's a religion in that sense. So from that point of view, when you read with the bones, you're reading with your ancestors, you're consulting your ancestors for guidance and insight. And each of the pieces that are in a kit have their own sort of special gifts and medicine and messages, of course, but they're alive. So like if one of them disappears, the thought is that, oh, well, it didn't want to talk to you anymore. It did its work. It's done. Right. And sometimes they'll come back. And sometimes like you'll find something that you really want to add to your bone collection, but you have to ask the spirit of the object first if it consents to be added to like your collection. Oh boy, now I'm getting into the like special interest like hyper fixation space. But like I find it really interesting, and part of what makes magic one of my favorite things to talk about, both from like a practitioner point of view, but also just like a curious person and like a historical point of view, is that magic and different forms of magic and people's relationships with either the supranatural or the supernatural can tell us a lot about what people value and what people find important and what different kinds of experiences they were having and what sort of the context of their lives was like, especially with divination, right?
Yeah. So can you do a quick, because you just very carefully said their relationship to the supranatural and the supernatural.
Yeah.
What's the flip there?
So the way that I was using it was, for me, the supranatural is about experiences that we can't explain, that we feel are firmly within sort of natural experience, and that are just like the natural extension of the world that's going on right around us. However, it is an antiquated form of supernatural.
Okay.
And the supernatural says that things are existing beyond like the laws of nature and physics. So the reason why I said it that way was because obviously different people have different points of view on what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of my colleagues and peers, like a surprising number, unless you do magic and then it's not surprising, are actually like mathematicians and scientists, mm-hmm. like with graduate degrees. One of my favorite teachers, and this is not to put Sarah on a pedestal, she's just really dope, is Sarah Mastros of Mastros and Zealot. She lives in Pittsburgh, and she's a Greek and Jewish witch who is just incredible. I believe she has her PhD in mathematics. I know she's definitely taught high school like kids calculus, which, you know, is a feat. And she's deeply mathematical, and we've had conversations about how magic is fundamentally magical, which there's a lot of historical philosophical context around that sort of notion, especially within both the Islamicate and Jewish traditions, very specifically about sort of magic existing as a function of math, because God is, you know, part of nature. Well, nature is part of God, or God is nature and one and the same, depending on the philosopher you're reading.
My undergrad was in chemistry, and we had a professor who gave a lecture that was, he was like, the carbon molecule is proof of God. The most deeply religious and out about the religion department on our campus was our chemistry department. Was our most religious department. And then it went from there. But it was, I don't even think I saw the lecture. Because in college, I would have been like, ugh, you're so wrong. But now I agree with them totally.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, like, I went through a phase where I was very, I just didn't give a shit about spiritual stuff, or like the existence and nature of God. But, you know, I didn't really have like an interest in that. And I went through a phase where I felt very disconnected from the world around me. And now, as an adult who is doing this work, I agree with my colleague when she says, you know, a lot of magic is just things that we have not yet learned to explain with math or science.
Mm-hmm.
And given that I also come from an Indigenous background, one of my adoptive mothers is Indigenous, and we are reasonably certain that my birth father is, my biological father, rather, is also an Indigenous man, but that's a whole complicated story we're mm-hmm. not going to get into. You know, a lot of Indigenous wisdom and a lot of Indigenous knowing has been proven to be scientifically sound, like in the last, you know, 50 years. And there have been some really exceptional, you know, ecological sciences professionals and researchers who have written about how, especially within an Indigenous context, you know, ritual is research. Ritual is the observation of the world around us for the purpose of benefically interacting with it and existing with it to the best of our abilities, you know, with minimal suffering to ourselves or to the other beings around us. And for me, that informs a lot of how I live my life now, and, you know, has given me a lens to look at the world that I feel is far more expansive and skeptical and curious than I may have had, you know, if I had just stayed in the space where I felt comfortable, which was just being numb to everything. Mm-hmm. And it's been hard, but, you know, it's been worth it. And it's been very challenging because I know what people think when they hear, you know, professional witch or professional psychic. You know, they think of Miss Cleo, who, right. I have a party story
about. You have a party story about?
Yes, I do have a party story about Miss Cleo. I actually met her.
Was Miss Cleo in person?
Yes.
Okay.
I met Miss Cleo when I was 21 at a party where I was reading on the patio for tips. It was an art and live music night at a little place called Mother Earth Cafe in West Palm Beach. And I didn't recognize her.
Sure.
I swear to God, I didn't recognize her. And she came and she sat down and she started talking to me and she asked me for a reading. And, you know, I did my thing and she got to the end. She was just like, "You really don't know who I am, do you?" And I was just like, "No, should I?" I just kind of like gave her like this look like, "No, ma'am." Like, and then she put on the accent. And I just like, apparently all the color must have left my face because Miss Patty, the woman who owned the cafe, who was outside smoking a clove cigarette, was behind her, started laughing while I like melted underneath the table.
Oh my gosh.
Because I realized who it was.
Were you doing a tarot reading for her?
Yes, I was. And she actually told me that I was very talented at what I did and that I should be careful with my skills and with my talents. We had an interesting conversation about the whole psychic friends network situation, and also just her own like spiritual life and practice.
Yeah,
you know, outside of that. And she was actually there reading poetry, which she was also a very talented poet, I should add. And it was just a really surreal fucking night.
Yeah.
I was just like, this is weird as hell.
That's so weird. I mean, no, of course you didn't recognize her outside of the context of a commercial.
Right. And also I was very little, like when the psychic friends network like situation went down, I think it was maybe like, I don't know, that was 90s. So I was sub 10 years old. So
might have only even known her like as an SNL sketch or like as an internet meme and not even known her commercials.
Yeah, like it was just such a weird cultural zeitgeist moment for me personally. But it was interesting because I was actually there that night with a guy, a friend that I knew from school who was very Christian. Mm-hmm. So the contrast.
Yeah.
Those two things happening at once was quite interesting. But, you know, even at that stage of my life, I didn't really know what I was doing with the path that I was walking down. And a lot of my traditions, so in terms of like specific traditions that I work out of, I am a lay practitioner of Haitian Vodou, although it's pretty likely I'm probably going to end up either Mirage Loa, which is a marriage to a Loa, which I'm happy to elaborate on what that means, or initiated sometime maybe in like the next 5 to 6 years. It's going to be a minute for various reasons, not just, you know, me not being ready.
Yeah.
Because there's no such thing as divorce in Vodou. Once you cross that threshold, it's a life, baby.
Yeah.
So there's that. I'm also a root worker, so I practice hoodoo in terms of formal traditions. And I just have like a hodgepodge of like sorceress stuff that I draw on work out of. And I'm Jewish, which is also a weird situation. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we've connected
yep.
over and about.
Yep.
and me trying to figure out how I'm going to explain myself to a rabbi.
Yeah.
So that's also been like a really complicated like part of my journey too, because I was raised in a secular Jewish sort of like household, secular, mm-hmm. secular Jewish values, around my Jewish extended family. But my parents, which was kind of a bizarre choice because they were two old gay white ladies mm-hmm. in the deep South in the 90s. Why would you choose the Catholic Church right. over like trucking us to a synagogue? But then I realized probably because the only synagogue in town at that point was Orthodox, which right. would have explained
right
making pattern there, because the Catholics will take anybody,
right?
So you know, but so we were quasi barely raised like doing CCD classes that I never gave a crap about.
Right.
But like we casually celebrated Hanukkah. We did like Shabbat dinners at my grandmother's like condo, you know, periodically, like, you know, the cultural sort of experiences. And I had a lot of Jewish friends, you know, went to plenty a bar and bat mitzvah. Mm-hmm. But I didn't come back around to Judaism until I was an adult, when that parent passed away. And I just felt this really intense need to sit Shiva for her. And she was not religious at all. So I have yeah. no clue why the hell that happened. And then fast forward 2 years later, the Tree of Life synagogue shooting happened. And mm-hmm. that did weird things to me emotionally. Yeah. So, you know, my web weaving here is very complicated, but, yeah. I love it all. And I find it really fascinating, as I already said, because it tells us so much about how people exist and how we have things in common. So like, for example, it's not anywhere within my reach, right now, but I'm taking a class on a document called the Papyri Magica Gricae. Oh my God, I can speak. also known as the PGM, which is a collection of demiotic magical scrolls that were assembled during the Hellenistic period of ancient Egypt. And it's basically all folk magic. It's kind of treated a little bit like pinkies up, like, you know, a little bit snobby now because uh-huh. It's old and shit. But in reality, the actual contents of the scrolls and what we have left of these papyri are all folk magic. It's all how can I make Susie love me? Well, obviously not Susie, but
right.
know, pick a name. You know, this bastard stole my cow.
Right. It's all the same issues that like went into that are in like the Talmud. Like yeah. if this person steals your cow and they don't harm the cow and you get it back, or they do harm the cow, or they harm your pregnant spouse, or they do this. It's all about like complicated solutions to minor grievances.
Yeah.
And some major grievances. I'm not going to say it right. Like,
yeah.
But it's so much of like Jewish tradition is about applying Torah to mm-hmm. modern situations.
Yeah.
It's why I love being Jewish so much, and why part of why I converted was I was like, oh, well, here's a scaffolding. Like Judaism provides a scaffolding for decision making.
Yeah. And I mean, like, that's exactly, like, if I had to describe why I also love Judaism and why, where Judaism sort of wraps itself into my life, it is that scaffolding. I've always said that, you know, from the outside looking in, I can understand why somebody just, like, picking up a random tractate of the Talmud would be like, what in the...
Yeah.
Put a baby? Like, put a baby on a butt? What?
Mm-hmm.
But I was just like, it's the exercise of, like, ethics and logic, right? Yeah. It's having these interesting conversations about theoreticals in order to be able to distill, you know, really practical, consistent applications of wisdom that also evolve in response to human evolution, ideally. Yeah. And it's really interesting because a lot of what we would culturally term Jewish magic, which is a whole academic fuss unto itself as to what qualifies under that banner, you know, reflects a lot of those tendencies as well. So, like, I totally get it, because I've said often that one of the things that I deeply appreciate about Judaism is this depthful inquiry into what makes us tick and how we sort of operate as a unit and as a society. Mm-hmm. And like, really sophisticated bodies of wisdom are dotted across the planet. A really great sort of like parallel example, slightly different, would actually be the body of wisdom around a divination system called the Dilagun, which is a form of West African divination with shells. So if you've ever seen, what the hell is it? Spike Lee's, I think she's got to have it on Netflix, the revised series.
Yeah.
There's a scene where one of the characters has his shells read by his sister.
All right.
That's the divination system.
Okay.
But basically, this divination system has been around for thousands of years. And here, I will physically show you the Book of Prophets, which are parables. I'm not allowed to read Dilagun because I'm not an initiated priestess. So, you know, none of that for me.
Yeah.
But it's like a whole textbook. And this is just what's in English, right? And coming out of one house of Santeria.
Sure.
So, like, you know, they have like these really sophisticated and very thoughtful sort of reflections and prescriptions on how to deal with things and how to deal with one another. And I find that really interesting to kind of compare worldviews, not for the sake of determining, you know, which one is better. That's absurd. But just kind of better understanding how the different conditions around different people's lives, you know, manifest. Mm-hmm. And with magic specifically, going back to an academic point of view, so I don't bore the hell out of your audience. you know, like if you look at the difference between like what's considered folk magic and sort of the body of work that's kind of considered like Western occultism, which I'm putting in quotes, a lot of what makes that distinction is that the things that we would consider Western occultism were things that were accessible to people of means, usually the clergy, because they either had the wealth to be able to afford to mount these ridiculous ceremonies, and they had the ability to read and write. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the times, like the formation of grimoires was by learned members of clergy, usually the Catholic Church, which is a little bit of a scandal, depending on where you say that. But, you know, there was like definitely like a difference. You can tell like the difference in concerns and worldviews just based on where practice came from and when and where and how it was sort of like recorded or otherwise like passed from person to person, right? So I find all of that fascinating because it gives me insight into how people operate now and how to better sort of navigate those situations.
Yeah, and I do think it's interesting because when you pulled out that book about reading shells, you said like this is like what's available in English and is from one house, which I think people who are Jewish who listen know that, like, everybody's, you ask, like, hey, can I do XYZ? Everybody's always like, talk to your rabbi.
Yes.
Talk to your rabbi. My rabbi might say something different. There's no answer. Go talk to your rabbi. So that to me is a parallel where it's like you follow a specific within a broader worldview, religion, set of rules. You have the traditions of the rabbi that you get advice from or the, you know, the lineage. So I think that's really interesting. And I also think there's like so much was preserved through oral tradition that like, and I can only draw the parallels I can draw. So, mm-hmm. which is that in Judaism, the oral Torah is written down. Mm-hmm. Because eventually enough people got literate and to like really get it down, we wrote it down. But we've got a book we call the Oral Torah because it was what was people's jobs were to remember different parts of it. And so there is also the point of like, when does an oral tradition get written down to better share and pass it? And what does the translation, what does the risk of translation do to it? And I think all of that stuff is really interesting when you look at, I'm just going to say religions, because that's mm-hmm. kind of how I understand it, of how would they get passed between generations, between clergy, what is oral, what is written, what is translated, and your access to the tools of the trade.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's interesting because, as I mentioned, like my primary tradition, structured tradition, one of them is Haitian Vodou. And Vodou is decentralized. There's no central authority per se in Haitian Vodou in any self anointed mm-hmm. official authority. It's just kind of like, all right, cool. Whatever, we don't care.
That's a red flag.
Yeah, like everybody's just like, oh. All right. But we do have a lineage system. So like, if you are meant to become clergy, you have a godparent or mm-hmm. godparents. And usually you're given an initiatory name, that distinguishes who you are before the loa, but also who you are in relationship, to your godparent and to, your societe, which is the society. Different societies have like different reglement, which is a ritual process, right? But however, those reglement differences vary slightly mm-hmm. Depending on where the tradition is from in Haiti. So a lot of times the division is usually northern Haiti versus southern Haiti because right. there's differences politically and geographically, right? In terms of the land and like all that kind of stuff. But within Vodou, teaching is almost exclusively oral. And a lot of sort of the prayers and some of the invocations that are used, you know, during various rituals and various rites, are called, langage, oh my God, which is a Creole word, which just means the language, because they don't actually remember what those words mean, because they came out of the interactions of the various enslaved people who were brought to Haiti and started collaborating with one another to kind of match up their spiritual systems as much as they possibly could, right? So like there's whole chunks of things that we don't actually quite know what they mean.
Right.
We know that they were.
you know the gist.
Yeah. And, you know, scientists and researchers have either, because part of the controversy is that sometimes, like specifically ethnographers will present themselves as like approaching these things in good faith and get access to spaces that are sacred and private and then take those things and put them out in public.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, then we get into this really hard discussion about what happens. So specifically speaking to Vodou, so what's happening right now in Haiti is You know, the Catholic Church has generally always kind of looked the other way at folk traditions. They're just like, as long as you show up to church, like,
yeah,
every Sunday you tithe and you come on.
You need a Virgin Mary? You got one. This one jumped out the back of a wagon. Fixed right? your wheels. That's the one in Tandil in Argentina. Like, yeah, you need one? We got you. Like I am speaking so disrespectfully of a church I'm not a member of, but like they could not have become a global religion without looking the other way / embracing local traditions.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, I think a lot of people kind of like gloss over that, but I made a joke, like, and I'm allowed to make this joke because I was baptized at one point. Mm-hmm. You know, like the Catholic Church recognizes 10,000 plus canonized saints.
Yeah.
And I was just like, if that ain't like an ancestor cult and a papal friggin' minor, like,
yeah.
I don't know like what it is. But in the case of like Vodou, the Catholic Church has always kind of looked the other way. They've done this with Santeria in Cuba. You know, if you ask most Vodou saints in Haiti what their religion is, they will usually tell you they are Catholic.
Right.
Or they will very rarely say that they are like some flavor of Protestant. However, what has been going on since the first big earthquake circa the early 2000s, like early 2010s, is that evangelical organizations from the United States very specifically have been going into Haiti and radicalizing the Haitian public. And they're doing it through manipulating aid to Haitian people by opening schools, by requiring families to convert in order to be able to have mm-hmm. their children be eligible to go to these better, safer schools or to receive food or whatever it is, right? And I just want to preface this here with like a little like asterisk. I know it's not all Christians, but these specific evangelical Christians have right. been doing this. And in the process of doing this, they've also very, very heavily demonized Vodou as a tradition. And there's a reason for that, because Vodou in Haiti has always had, I will say, an accepted but uneasy relationship with Vodou, because it's very Black and very African, and, you know, there are lots of political layers there, but Vodou is central to the Haitian liberation story.
Right.
The Boascaman was a very major event. We know it happened. We know Dodi Buckman was a real person. We don't actually know what was said or done during that event. We have some idea, but the symbolism of that alone was enough that it set off riots even like in the United States amongst slaves who were brought from the islands to New Orleans, which is why they stopped importing enslaved people from the islands and bringing them to New Orleans. But these evangelicals have been declaring Vodou spirits to be, you know, demons and doing really abusive things. They've been burning down societies and tearing apart shrines. Like, it's just absolutely brutal persecution of Vodou practitioners on the island. And what has happened is the numbers are starting to dwindle, you know, because Haiti is just has a lot on its poor plate. But it started to grow in the diaspora, specifically in the United States. And it's brought up a lot of interesting dialogue around cultural appropriation, but also like, how do you tend to a faith and to a belief system that is so not only intimately tied to land of place, but also language and also oral tradition in a way that doesn't dilute it out as like this unfortunate kind of cultural disaster is taking place.
Right.
I consider what's happening in Haiti and with Vodou to be a form of cultural genocide. Yeah. Like, I you know, and if I say that in some rooms, people would be like, oh, that's really strong language. Are you sure you want to do that? And I'm just
It sounds exactly like what many of us have only recently become aware of with Indian boarding schools.
Yeah. Like, you know, like, and you know, Native American children being brutally beaten, like if they spoke in their own languages, you know, which is part of one of my projects as well, as I'm trying to learn Cherokee, which is very hard for a variety of reasons, because the worldview is entirely different when you speak Cherokee. But, you know, like it's been really interesting being a guest in this house, because I'm not Haitian. I was not born on Haitian soil. So my position in the tradition is very different than somebody who isn't even Black and was born in Haiti.
Right.
Which surprises some Black folks in the United States when I tell them that there are a number of societies in Haiti that wouldn't accept them, but they would accept a white person who was born in Haiti on Haitian soil. I get a lot of looks. Like, I'm just like, it's because of the place, right? It's because of the soil. Like, I understand, I think I have a relationship that I do with Vodou because it's very much connected to being in a place. Like, a lot of, all of the Loa are expressions of places in nature and places in the world around us, you know, and it's hard to kind of navigate this context in the 21st century with globalization and have to fight with misinformation,
right,
with people who will watch like American Horror Story and, you know, see representations of Papa Legba as, you know, tech. That's a whole, I could go off on a on a tangent about poor Papa Legba being demonized, which, like, of all the Loa, you're going to pick the one who's represented by St. Lazarus with a fucking cane? Like, what? A lot of times people will take the imagery of Bawan Semedi, who is the Baron of the Cemetery, who's a spirit of the dead. He's a member of the Gede Nation, which is all the dead folk. And they will put that on Legba. Legba's an old man. Like, for the most, like, you still shouldn't fuck with him because he's a trickster. But, like, he's a little old man with a straw hat and, like, his, like, like, pipe. Like, he doesn't bother anybody.
He's just sitting on a stump. He's just having a little smoke, relaxing. Right?
Like, his
altar. Trying not to overheat.
Yeah, like, his altar is right next to my door, because that's where he customarily sits, is by the door. But, like, you know, watching, like, all of these sort of, like, cultural phenomena happening, and then sort of like trying to reconcile and sort of, you know, discern what is a tradition growing and adapting and evolving, and what is a tradition being dismantled and destroyed.
Right.
Because there are a lot of lines that get crossed, you know, in that process. And the other tradition that I practice, Hoodoo, has really, really badly experienced sort of cultural desecration, in my opinion, because for a really long time, you know, if you went up to a granny, like, somewhere in the deep south and, like, asked her if she did, like, hoodoo, she'd look at you sideways and ask you, like, if you, like, walked with the devil. But then if you asked her, like, if you tried to, like, sweep her feet, like, if you tried to take a broom over her feet, she'd probably take the broom and beat you with
it. Right.
You know, and, like, if you tried to do laundry, like, on the first of the year, she'd be like, no, baby, like, take that out of the laundry. We don't do that.
Yeah.
You're going to wash the luck away. Right. And so, like, a lot of, like, these Southern, and because I know we're on a podcast, so people can't see me, but I'm doing air quotes.
Yeah.
Like, folk practices, Southern superstitions,
right,
are actually manifestations, and most of the South, not all the South, but most of the South, of the practices that slaves adapted to, enslaved people rather, adapted to their context, right? Hoodoo, in terms of like its techniques and its liturgical body, is very much a response to the conditions of being enslaved. Mm-hmm. They thought they died, like spiritually speaking, when they came here, because in West Africa, obviously, like there are different versions and different nuances, so we don't want to like boil like cultures down. But the most like specifically within a Congo context, we view the afterworld as Kalunga, and Kalunga is a vast body of water where the ancestors rest at the bottom, right? And they have like their own existence and their own society and their own flow at the bottom of this big, you know, body of water. So imagine if you were enslaved and taken over a vast ocean, packed like sardines into a horrible ship. Like there's this sort of internal process of probably feeling like you died. And that's very much
reflected. And that the afterlife is much more vivid than you maybe anticipated.
Right. And also just like the spiritual loss of that. So like when you look at the ethnographies that were done of like these practices that constitute the body of what we would call hoodoo, Katrina, Dr. Katrina Hazard-Donald has a really great book called Mojo Working, which I really love. It's so well done on this subject. But when you look at you know, the ethnographies that we have, the two big ones being the work of Dr. Zora Neale Hurston, who did Go Tell My Horse, and I can't remember the titles of the other two right now because it's 9:30 at night and I've had a long day. But the Go Tell My Horse is the big one. She's also she also did a couple of others specifically on the States, but she also did them on the islands, as well as Hyatt's Hoodoo, which is, you can't get a copy of the five volumes for less than $30,000 now, because like it's out of print, and a lot of the completed copies are in university libraries.
Wow.
But I got very lucky and I got PDF scans, bless the person who scanned to those thousands of pages of material.
Oh my gosh.
But when you look at those, like there is kind of like a reflection of the sensibilities that came up in response to slavery. So like, for example, it's called root working because a lot of when there are cosmological reasons for it, but the practical one too is that it's using a lot of materia and plants, right? Because one of the things
literal roots.
Yeah, like literal roots that were used to prepare medicine for enslaved people because they weren't given access to health care.
Right.
Like doctors didn't treat them. But on an interesting sort of flip side to that, the white people who enslaved these folks also forced them to treat the slave owning families. So we have lots of like historical records of slaves preparing medicine for sick children, for sick slave masters. Then on the flip side of that, also poisoning them.
Sure.
so like there's like this overlapping history there as well that tells us a lot about the conditions that they were facing. Like if you look at sort of like the oral tradition and also some of like the written down like ethnographic information that we have about the use of these plants. Not only do we see in certain areas where indigenous communities had contact with freed Black folk, how their sort of cultures and traditions interacted with that, but we also see how a lot of the plants that we find in West Africa either came with them because they were braided into their hair or because like they found very similar plants that they crossbred into a new variety here in, you know, Turtle Island. And like seeing like the sort of like legacy of these things. But what ended up happening was because Christianity became such a central part of the abolition movement, and also just slave life in general, because they were forced to. And also for a sizable chunk of the people who were brought to the States, a lot of people don't know this, Christianity was already in Africa at that point. The Kingdom of Congo was already on, had already undergone a mass conversion, where Catholicism at one point was the state religion of the Congo Empire, which was a whole thing. And then it reverted, and then it went back. A whole mess.
There was there was a viral TikTok recently of some white kid, like, he was probably Mormon, but he was like making this TikTok before I go to Ethiopia on my, you know, like on his missionary trip. And it's just duet after duet of people are like, oh, you're going to be surprised when you get there and find out it is a Christian country. Like,
you are not
bringing Christianity to Ethiopia. And he's just getting roasted. He's going to be roasted the whole 2 years he's gone. And he's going to come back to TikTok and find out what happened.
Yeah, I mean, because like the Ethiopian kingdom like predates the Catholic Church by a significant amount. But even like in West Africa, you know, like missionaries were dispatched to Angola and to, well, modern day Angola, but to like this region. And also because of trade, right, there was encounters with Christianity. Islam was also already in the region as well. Some of the slaves who were brought to the States, some of the people who were enslaved, I like to say people who were enslaved rather than slaves, because slaves is humanizing, you know, were practicing Islam, and brought that with them. So we can kind of see like these crossovers into these traditions, because this was already part of like the social cohesion and the language that was going on. And then over time, as we sort of moved out of, you know, the post-antebellum period into like Jim Crow, these practices kind of got absorbed into the broader like cultural landscape, as many Black things do, especially in the South, but also generally in the United States, and kind of lost their cohesion as like as a unit of social bonding, right, and spiritual bonding, and just kind of became folk practices, right? And what ended up happening was is that some of the more prominent sort of lineages of this kind of work turned into charismatic Black church traditions. So like if you look at like Kojic, which is a whole basket of kids. I was not raised in the Black church, so I speak of this as an outsider who has looked in and then closed the curtain. You know, like the speaking in tongues, like the anointing with oils, like gifts of the spirit. It's just like, you know what those things,
right?
You know what those things are. Interesting. You know, so like those then turned into like these big institutions within the Black community. You know, that weren't necessarily recognized as being indigenous traditions.
Right.
And there's like a whole conversation there about like white supremacy and assimilation, you know, and how that sort of impacted the spiritual landscape. But what you're seeing now is like a lot of young Black women, especially in the United States, kind of going back to these traditions to try to find themselves outside of, you know, this very patriarchal, very white supremacist sort of narrative.
Yeah.
And it's really fascinating to watch, especially as somebody who, you know, unintentionally got a little bit of a head start on that. I'm not bragging, to be clear. I'm just saying, like, I got like a 3 year, I was on the train, you know, like about 5 years before it really started to hit the zeitgeist.
So there's patriarchal and white supremacy have combined to turn hoodoo traditions into Black charismatic churches.
Yes.
And now young Black women.
Yes. So I was talking about like the struggle between like tradition and sort of like what is traditional innovation and what is sort of like a traditional deconstruction. And we're seeing that with hoodoo, because a lot of the material and a lot of the publications that have been made available outside of, you know, very specific academic disclosures, which are also majority white people, have been written by white people. They've been presented as, you know, hoodoo is for everyone, or it's a Black tradition, but anybody can practice hoodoo, you know, yada, yada. And people have turned it into whole businesses and brands because the magic works, you know, which I try not to, when I talk to magic about magic to non-magical audiences, I try not to make statements like that.
Right.
But, you know, it works enough, you know, that somebody's granny remembered the recipe for fast luck oil for 50 fucking years.
Right.
you know, and it's really hard to kind of track what is a modern invention versus what is a traditional one. And like a really great example that I give of this when I lecture, when I'm allowed to lecture like this on my special interests, is like honey jars, right? So if you have any sort of passing familiarity with magic at all, at some point you've probably seen a sweetening jar or somebody mention a recipe about sweetening somebody, because it's usually somebody and it's usually in a love context.
Right.
You know, of trying because some problems don't change kind of the time in human history. I know.
Anytime I talk, I have got a clairvoyant that I talk to regularly, you know, a few times a year. And I'm like, there are only three questions. It's love, really work. It's like love, work, money, family. Like there are no other questions. Like don't tell me to come up with questions for you. Those are the questions.
I mean, it's true. It's very true. Those are the only three things people give a crap about.
Yeah.
you know, which is why I got super lucky with my you know, luck of the draw in terms of just like my magical skill, because, you know, I do my Juno jar work.
Yes, I was hoping we would get to the Juno jar.
but like, as I was saying, so this is actually a really great segue into my Juno jar work. So my Juno jar work, I do it twice a year. And it's, I make a magical vessel that is a honey jar. And it's, I take like a very large, it's now very large because this thing has gone, has developed a mind of its own every twice a year.
It's not unpopular.
Yes. It's crazy. I have a waiting list. It's not at all what I anticipated. But in this jar, I combine usually raw organic honey, because it's got to be like organic, because I'm a bougie, you know, hoe about these things, with various specific materia that are chosen for the type of medicine and like from a both magical perspective, but also just like looking at how it functions in a homeopathic context, which is not a thing I'd ever thought I'd say, but here I am. and I add it to this jar with the petitions of my participants, which are their goals and intentions for the next year-long period. So I put this jar together, I seal it up.
And you're pretty specific with those of us who participate. And I have, I think, probably three times, I think, that, you know, that this is a wealth building, like, don't slip a romance petition into the Juno jar, because that's not the purpose.
Yeah, like that's not the focus of the
it won't work.
The Juno jar.
It won't work.
It might work, but that's not the point of the magic. So to like, don't waste your money.
Right.
but basically what I do is once I add all these petitions and a ritual, I then do a form of magic, which is called theurgy, where I work with Juno, who is a Roman goddess. She's specifically the Roman goddess of the state, but also of the treasury and of women and children and marriage, lesser. So there's some debate around that. And I seat her essence into the jar, therefore making the jar a living expression and manifestation of her energy. And I feed and I tend that jar daily for an entire year before I then dismantle it and release the energy from it. And I say thank you and I move along. So I do this work, and it's inspired in part by my background in hoodoo. Because when people think of hoodoo, one of the first, if they know anything about hoodoo at all, the first thought that they'll go to is like a honey jar. Mm-hmm. But the thing is that honey is actually a very modern invention in the scale of time when it comes to hoodoo. Because traditionally speaking, enslaved persons and also Black folks who were freed Black folks did not have regular access to honey until commercial bee farming became more of a thing.
Okay.
So nobody really had access to a consistent source of honey.
Right.
So traditionally speaking, honey jars are actually sugar bowls, molasses bowls, or like cane syrup bowls. So they would use cane syrup, molasses, powdered sugar, things that you could get a hold of pretty easily, usually molasses. Molasses is probably the most traditional of all of them for various reasons. And they would use that as the sweetener.
Okay.
And we think that honey sort of evolved out of this context because honey became much more ubiquitous after a certain point, much more popular in terms of an ingredient. Honey also has some corollary functions in European traditions of folk magic, in terms of like love and sweetness and wealth and like all of that kind of stuff. Bees have a really strong association with the dead in Greek tradition. So there's also a little bit of like that crossover as well, but we don't think we're pretty sure honey didn't become like a prominent part of this process until after commercial bee farming became like a thing. Before that, it was molasses. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times, like if you work with a very traditional root worker, humst are hard to find on the internet for various reasons.
Sure.
Mostly because they're 80 million years old at this point, or they are in very, very rural communities that want nothing to do with outsiders, which is also very understandable. They will work with these more traditional materials. But going back to my Juno jar, I started doing this because I was in a pickle. And I was living with my sister at the time, who was going through a divorce from her now ex-husband. And I was living in her very large sort of like back closet area, the room between sort of like the main apartment and like the back door.
Yep.
And I needed to skedaddle up out of there because the kids needed space because, you know, law and custody shit. So I panicked because I had basically melted into my bed for a year because my sister loved me enough to just let me come vegetate in her house for a year.
Yeah.
And I had started working with Juno because I don't like working with Jupiter. So Jupiter, the planet, is different than Jupiter, the deity. So Jupiter, the planet, he's not my favorite, but I make do. Whereas Jupiter, the deity, is basically the caricature of imperial Rome. He's the big dog of capitalism. He's the big dog of white supremacy. There's like a whole thing there that I could get into about like the politics of imperial Rome leading into modern white supremacy. So Jupiter and I don't play well together because I'm not about like this ceaseless expansion kind of bullshit. I'm very much a Saturn girl. Saturn was the god of Carthage and Judea, which were the only two states that the Roman Empire never fully conquered. So I don't play well with Jupiter. But unfortunately, Jupiter is the one who gets called on and gets cited for a lot of like the more structured wealth magic that you'll find outside of like, you know, folk magic spells for fast money because an unexpected bill came.
Right.
So I was just like, well, fuck that bastard. I don't get good results with him. I don't like this. And Jason Miller happens to have a communal, because he runs a course called Strategic Sorcery. Mm-hmm. That's literally the name of the course, the Strategic Sorcery Correspondence course. And we have global rites that go out like periodically throughout the year. And one of them was Juno. And I did that rite one time on a whim, mm-hmm. and I had such good results that I was like, well, shit. Let me keep working with you. And the very first time I ever actually worked with her, I went into, it's so weird talking about magic stuff to normal people. I had a visionary experience where I saw this absolutely radiant, very dark-skinned African woman who came to me in a vision, and she's kind of like booped me on my nose. Like, of all the things that I could envision, like if I wanted to have like a she literally just booped me on the nose and like went away, like faded out, and I was just like, so that's a thing. And I went about my merry business. But then fast forward like 3 months later, my sister tells me that I need to be out of her apartment and, you know, like 60 days.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to live with anybody else. And I had no credit history outside of my student loans. And I went to Juno and I panicked and I said, help. I'm about to be in some real deep shit. So I should clarify that when I say spirits talk to me, I'm not hearing voices per se. Mm-hmm. Like I'm not like having a cycle. I always feel like I need to explain myself. I'm not hearing voices in the way that, you know, I would be taking myself to a therapist if I were hearing voices like that. But I basically had the sense of let's do this. And I ended up having a dream where she explained what she wanted me to do with this jar. And I was just like, no, like, you sure we don't have anything else?
Right. Like, we do something a little less messy than honey, jars of honey and candles and beeswax and really?
Well, and also, like, I had experimented with doing, like, a small honey jar service before that, and I had gotten some positive response for it, but we have to remember that at this point in the timeline, I was still in abject denial about what my destiny was. Mm-hmm. So I was just like, can't you just, like, find me a job? Like, invent, like, a business? Or, like, something other than this?
Right.
And I was just like, well, shit, if I don't do this, like my ass is gonna be on fire. So I just put it out there. I didn't expect that anybody would sign up. And then I think for that first jar, I had 50 or 60 signups. And in addition to that, my petition was for the money in order to be able to move. And shortly after the jar like happened, there was a dust up with a white woman, which we're not going to get into because another whole dramatic situation. But the end result was that I walked away with a tax-free gift of $30,000 as part of like an informal fellowship thing that never actually materialized as a formal fellowship. So it wasn't considered taxable income because I checked with the CPA because I didn't want to get in trouble with Uncle Sam. But that money, between the Juno jar sales and that experience, was enough that I was able to rent my very first apartment, my very first little studio, all by myself.
Yeah.
And I was able to purchase the original of a painting called Hera's Compassion, which was painted by Christy Townsend. It's above my altar right now. It's one of my prized possessions. It's insured. And it shows a dark-skinned Black woman with braids holding a dove in her hands. And she's got a peacock feather like off to the side. So this was interesting because almost all depictions of Hera, because they're basically none of Juno for various reasons, are all white women. Like they're never Black women. And usually I won't swap Hera imagery in for Juno stuff.
Right.
Because there's reasons for that, like just on a, like a decorum level. But as soon as I saw that painting, I nearly passed. Because I've never seen that before in my entire life. And I sent Christy an email and I was just like, if you still have the original, can you hold it for me?
Yeah.
Like, and let me know how much it is. And I went to Juno and I said, if you can make this happen, I will buy this painting for you. And I will make it known that this is like how you prefer to be seen. You know, which is not popular with certain racist segments of the pagan community, but eat my ass. like we're pretty positive she was an African goddess, like,
right?
Kick rocks.
Yeah.
So that's how that whole thing happened. And you know, every year I kind of people would ask me, are you gonna do it again? Like, are you like, can you do them like quarterly? And I was just like,
you keep trying not to do them. You keep trying. You're like, this is the last time.
Yeah.
I'm moving on with my life. We're not doing this anymore.
Yeah. And then it just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And you know, the last jar I did, I actually, it's funny that we're having this conversation because the cart opens up for the winter 2022 on the 1st of November. Yeah. I literally open the cart in November and do the jar in January because that's how much of a sales period I need, because that's how many people want, like people have it on their calendars now, which is kind of wild to me. But then again, I also make that information available for people to do that, so I don't know why. it's just gotten bigger and bigger and bigger each year, and the testimonials are like, I cannot make any guarantees around magical stuff because that's unethical as cat shit.
Yeah.
And anybody who does is a liar, liar, pants on fire. Don't work with that person.
And you're also really clear in your writings and in your offerings, like, don't do this if you can't afford to, or pick the level that you can afford. Do this only of your own free will. Like, if you're compelled to do this by someone or being pressured into it, it's not for you. And you're like, it's not fine print. You are like, do not pass go. Like, this is all, you really do a good job, I think, of protecting people and making them understand that it may work, but there's no guarantee. And I think you do a really clear, you were very clear in your boundaries on that.
Yeah. There's an adage in hoodoo that goes, first comes the working, then comes the work.
Mm-hmm.
And I very much try to let people know that the work that I do has an appeal. It has an allure, because this shit wouldn't have lasted for thousands of years at this point if it wasn't doing something.
Right.
But that you have to meet it like halfway. Like, there's no like half-assing, you know, the process. And while sometimes you can be delivered like straight up miraculous shit, because I've been there and ridden that bull like three times. So like, it's no longer a fluke over here in Alexis verse. You know, like you, the best plans, the best way to use magic is in harmony with what we know practically works.
Right.
So I take a lot of strides because, unfortunately, a lot of my colleagues are, how shall I say, charlatans.
Snake oil salesmen.
Yes, just various uncouth and untenable and unethical people. You know, will make wild assertions, make wild guarantees. They will use like really manipulative language, like really manipulative sales tactics. One of my favorite examples of this is this jackass named E.A. Kettering. Don't go look up his stuff. He's a bum. But he's very much like the embodiment of like 35-year-old edgelord who hasn't like grown out of his teenage years. His brand is literally become a living god. But the funny thing about this cat is that he got arrested, I believe in 2012, and he was taken to Purgatory State Penitentiary because he got caught running drugs and guns. And I'm just like, God has a sense of humor. That's all I'm gonna say.
Was that in Colorado?
I think it was in Massachusetts, actually. I can't remember where he is right now, but he's literally
in purgatory.
Yeah. He then sprung the jail from the jail now, and is still out here being a mess. But like, he's like a really great example of like the kind of shit that I just am not interested in participating in.
Right.
But on the other side of the fence, are what I jokingly call crystal mommies.
Yeah.
You know, like these very lithe, hipster, well, not hipster, but you know, girl, gaslight, you know, gatekeep girl boss kind of flavored people.
Right.
You know, who are super into horribly mined like crystals and, you know, vaginal stuff and things, which has like a cultural context to it, but do they know any of that? No.
Right.
You know, like they also have kind of like the spiritual industrial complex that's kind of slick and preys on people's like insecurities and their desires for things in a way that's like really unethical and gross. And it's interesting for me because my traditions do in fact have a cultural precedence for exchange. If you need to be initiated, you have to pay for the animals, you know, that are given as an offering. Those animals are eaten, by the way. So it's not like, you know, wasteful. You have to pay for your own tools. You have to pay for the labor of the people who help do the ceremony, right? So like there's a cultural acceptance of some type of exchange there.
Right.
You know, there's even a cultural precedence of, you know, people being lifted out of poverty in Haiti due to being like a very talented mambo or hogan. Mm-hmm. But it's not the same as like capitalist commodification, right?
Yeah.
The principle of the exchange in these contexts is you don't get something for nothing, right? So like if you want the spirits to make a practical change on your part, you have to feed them because they have to do that work. They have to have a material connection in order to be able to do that work.
Yep.
Right. So for me, when I think about exchange within these contexts, I'm not trying to wring every last dollar out of my clients that I possibly can. I'm looking for what sustains me, what sustains my community, what sustains me in this work, and what gives my spirits the tools that they need to do the work that they do to the best of their ability.
Yep.
Right. And that's a really hard thing to kind of balance in this day and age of like Gary Vaynerchouts, you know, all over the place. Like, I'm not going to have 5,000 pieces of condom a day.
Right.
Like, that's just not going to happen.
No.
Like, there's a whole bunch of stuff I can't even like take photos of, you know, or I'll still start playing with the lights and telling him to like, fuck off. You know, it's like, it's really hard trying to like exist in what is essentially a very traditional I don't want to say ancient because that's cliche, but old as dirt, social role in this modern context under capitalism.
And in a pandemic.
Yeah. And also in times where there's a joke that magic is recession proof because people are desperate no matter what the time or place. Mm-hmm. And that's very true. I have not actually experienced a dip in my business. If anything, much to my mild horror, actually, I've had an uptick in business, which tells me that shit's real out there in these streets.
Yep.
So I feel like a really strong personal responsibility to make sure that I am not engaging in anything that could coerce my clients, that could represent spiritual abuse, that could represent an ethics violation, you know, in terms of just like the dynamics, the power dynamics of an exchange, you know, that I'm not taking these really vulnerable, sensitive, beautiful, private parts of people's lives and weaponizing them to take money like out of their pocket that they shouldn't be taking. Because I've had plenty of people who are just like, well, I'm just going to sign up for your Juno jar again. I'm just like, wait. Like, time out. Don't.
Right.
Like, you don't need to. Keep your money. You know, and that's not, unfortunately, that's not a common practice in a lot of spiritual spaces. People will enable all sorts of things, including like compulsive, like psychic visits. And I don't struggle to do it, but it's a lot of work to constantly be checking those boundaries to make sure that I'm able to do this work that I love and that I think is vitally important and, you know, just part of the landscape of being human, but doing it in a way that doesn't feed the structural sort of terrorisms that we have going on. And that's also part of the reason why all of my work has a magical oath attached, where I ask people, if you benefit materially from the work mm-hmm. that I do, you have to give back to others and not like the Red Cross. I mean, like, hit up some GoFundMe's. And some, yeah.
When you see those, when you see a thread of like, buy a coffee, toss your PayPal in here, you know, like, I have, because I would say I have benefited from your work. I remember the first one was like finding out that I was going to go to Barcelona, and I tacked on a trip to Paris to this like work trip to Barcelona. That was shortly after the first Juno jar, and I was freelancing, and I was really, things were really tight, but to be able to like add a low cost trip to a city I'd never been to. And then trying to find the mutual aid or the like in the communities I benefit from, like people whose work I've benefited from, who I have learned are unpaid, you know, like specifically there was this woman who did a shit ton of like unpaid diversity and inclusion work at UCB. It's a comedy theater in LA and New York. And then I found out like it was considered an internship and it was unpaid. And this was like when UCB was blowing up and falling apart last year. And when that tweet came through of sending her something because I do work in financial services, and when bonus season came around, 25% of that bonus went to my synagogue. Like, you know, have I done enough? Maybe not. Like, I'm trying, and I think we can always do better. So we are coming up on 2 hours.
Oh my goodness. What I will add like on to like summarize that conversation, because like for me, and I talk about this on my website, you know, my core operating ethos is radical luxury. It's this idea that everybody is deserving of a life that is beautiful and comfortable, regardless of where or who mm-hmm. they are in the world. And for me, that means rejecting certain ideas around work and labor. That means removing, dismantling capitalism, because I'm a communist. Woohoo. Mm-hmm. I'm specifically an anarcho-communist. So I'm not a statist communist. You know, it's doing acts of mutual aid, it's cultivating interdependence, it's putting a value on self-expression and comfort. So part of why I ask people to engage in that work is to really think about where their money is coming from, mm-hmm. for one, and what the absence of that money could have had, how that can have an impact on somebody.
Yeah.
But also about how abundance is interrelational. It's interdependent. Yep. We are interdependent on one another. We are also interdependent with the planet. And if we blow the planet up, if we blow one another up, eventually that'll come around to us. And like, you know, that's not an ethical or a conscious stewardship of the wealth and the abundance that we have, because my ancestors and their cultures have very different views of abundance and wealth than mm-hmm. that of, you know, sort of American hypersteroid capitalism, the dystopian universe that we're currently living in.
Yeah.
So I try to have my work adapt to that. And I think I've been pretty successful given the feedback that I've gotten. You know, my favorite stories to receive from clients are emails about like mutual aid donations and contributions that people have done. You know, my community raised $20,000 for a single mother. Mm-hmm. Well, she's not a single mother. Pardon. Sorry, Tiffany. But Tiffany and her kids who are in a tight spot. And we did that in less than 24 hours.
Yeah.
And like watching like the magic of that like unfold, and like seeing how people are kind of reevaluating their relationships, not only with what's possible for their life on an individual level, but what's possible for society on a big picture level. Mm-hmm. And then also taking steps to connect the two and to put those things into action has been one of the greatest honors of my life. And the only reason why, when I realized that I was on a feedback loop, and the only answer was yes around the spiritual stuff, I finally decided to say yes, even though it's a weird job to have in the 21st mm-hmm. century.
Yeah. Well, Alexis, thank you so much for joining me tonight. Would you like people to find you on the internet?
Sure. As long as they are not trolls, but I don't think anybody in your audience would do that to me. Mm-hmm. So
they don't stick around.
You can find me at alexispmorgan.com. I'm also on Facebook at Alexis P. Morgan. Those are the two primary places you can find me. My Instagram is dead right now, and I have not gotten on the tickety talks with the children, so.
Or with the middle-aged Jewish ladies, whatevs. Some of us are middle-aged Jewish ladies on TikTok. I love it. But you have more important things to do with your time than like a TikTok.
My sister keeps sending them to me, and I'm just like, dang it, I'm gonna like, I have a profile, I just haven't made any myself.
Oh, well, if you have someone curating TikTok for you, you don't need to join.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the conclusion that I've come to.
Yeah.
But I'm mainly on Facebook and my website, my mailing list, especially in light of Facebook's little oopsies a mm-hmm. week and some change ago, is a great place to find me. I will be sending out more emails in the future. But yeah, that's where I'm at. And I'm always happy to answer questions people have. And, you know, all that kind of good stuff. I do a lot of education. I am usually the first person a lot of people meet who come mm-hmm. into contact with me who does magic like this.
Yep.
So I'm always happy to be a learning resource and to yeah. be a positive first introduction.
Yeah, there's ton that people can learn just by sitting back and reading your Facebook musings. And certainly I've learned a lot, and helping wire some of the, you know, I am trying to learn to say people who were enslaved, right? I'm trying to learn to change that language around just a lot of, you know, Gen X, right?
Yeah.
That I grew up with. And if people want to contact you, your preferred is email, not Facebook Messenger, right?
Yes. Please send me an email. It will disappear into the Facebook Messenger abyss otherwise. Yeah. That is alexis@alexispmorgan.com. I'm pretty sure there is an email in my bio that's also for my assistant. Mm-hmm. Either one is fine. But I have a no DMs rule because at one point in my journey, I had a lot of little white women with a lot of complex and guilt around white supremacy who would regularly crawl into my DMs and write me six paragraphs about yeah. the existential nature of their white guilt. And I finally had to be like, no. No, my
buy
DMs.
A book, people. Buy a book.
So email is preferred, and I usually takes me about a week to 2 weeks to answer emails because I am disabled and I have a lot of my plate, but I will answer you eventually.
Yes. Great. Well, Alexis, thank you so much for joining me this evening. You can follow me. I'm at Chicago Leah. The podcast is at Finding Faves Pod on Instagram and Twitter, where I'll post a little clip every week. Please subscribe on iTunes or Spotify. Rate it 5 stars. Give me a nice little review. Everything helps. And sign up for Juno Jar if you are not compelled to do it. Wait.
I also am adding some services too. So if you meander yeah. over to my site, there will be various things up and going. I would love to have anybody who wants to sign up for my Juno Jar do so, but please do not feel pressured.
Yeah. Do this thing that we're talking about, but not because we told you to do the thing, but because you want to do the thing, but not because we pressured you to do the thing. Through marketing, which is not the thing we're doing right now. We're just talking about opportunities
yes,
to do the thing.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
This was really fun, and I rarely get to natter my brands out about magical stuff, so I always enjoy sharing.
It's the point of the podcast.
Thank you for listening to Finding Favorites with Leah Jones. Please make sure to subscribe and drop us a 5-star review on iTunes. Now, go out and enjoy your favorite things.